Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to Smarty Pants, the podcast of the American Scholar magazine. I'm your host, Stephanie Bastek. In a landscape littered with the riches of the hyphenated American novel, Korean-American, Nigerian-American, Mexican-American, it's hard to go back and remember a time when none of these books were out there. When the only thing you'd find in bookstores from Asian-American authors were missionary memoirs and Chinese cookbooks, this episode is about the first Japanese-American novel. So imagine you're back in 1956. It's barely a decade after World War II has ended and you're second-generation Japanese-American, or Nisei. Your parents were in the internment camps, but they don't want to talk about it. You fought in World War II, but some of your friends refused to fight. They were no-no boys who got their nicknames from answering no to two trick questions from the U.S. government that was trying to draft them. Those friends are out of prison now, but it's been a few years. The last thing you'd expect someone with that biography, someone like John Okada, would be to write a novel that explodes every stereotype of the model minority, the quiet Americans who just want to get by after a dark period of history. But John Okada does. He writes his first novel, No-No Boy, in 1956, about Ichiro Yamada, a fictional draft resistor who earns 2 years in prison and the hostility of his family and community when he returns to Seattle. Ichiro is no quiet American. He's got a voice and a character that American fiction has never seen. But John Okada's novel is ignored because everybody wants to put that history behind them. The book goes out of print, John Okada never publishes again, and he dies in obscurity in 1971. Luckily for us, though, that's not the end of the story. Frank Abe is one of the co-editors of John Okada, a new book that for the first time paints a full picture of the novelist's life, bundling his biography with newly discovered work and critical essays. Frank Abe joins us from Seattle to talk about the era in which No-No Boy was discovered. He was there, and what the book can teach us about our own moment. Thank you so much for joining us, Frank.
Well, thank you, Stephanie, for really taking an interest in this.
So can you tell us the story of how this book was rediscovered?
It's a great story. The legend goes that four writers, Frank Chin, Jeff Chan, Lawson Inada, Sean Wong, formed the Combined Asian American Resources Project in the early 70s. And the early 70s was a time of the birth of Asian American studies, a time when the field was just starting to emerge, and there was a need for texts. Writers were looking for their antecedents. They were looking for the writers who came before them, looking in used bookstores. And the legend goes that Jeff Chan stumbled in at a Berkeley bookshop and found a used copy of the hardcover of No-No Boy. They opened it up and were stunned to find this novel that was filled with the unexpressed rage of Japanese Americans following their mass incarceration by the U.S. government in World War II. It was a unique voice, an authentic voice, and they anthologized it in their groundbreaking anthology of Asian American literature called Ai, Ai being the sound that Japanese soldiers made when stabbed by U.S. soldiers in wartime propaganda movies. And as the writer Sean Wong says in his essay in our book, you know, No-No Boy resonated so much with the things he was trying to figure out as a young undergraduate at Berkeley. He was of draft age during the Vietnam War. The book was about making those kinds of decisions. Should I go into the army and potentially fight a war I thought was unjust, or should I go to prison? as Sean says in his essay, you know, John Okada wrote this novel just 10 years after the end of World War II. And Okada had no Japanese-American literary tradition to call upon or to inform his work. The man wrote in complete isolation. And to be able to hear his narrative voice in this book that they found in a used bookshop, disregarded and unknown, was an amazing feat. And so they not only anthologized it in IE, they decided to republish the book really out of their own pockets. And so they raised a couple $1,000s and reset the book, put a new cover on it. By coincidence and happenstance, my photograph was used as a basis for the drawing on the cover of the of that edition because I was an actor at the time working with Frank Chin at the Asian American Theater Workshop in San Francisco. And so my connection with the rediscovery of Noto Boy goes back to the very beginning.
Yeah, no kidding. So what happened next? The Carp Collective discovers this shockingly original book. I mean, I think they'd want to meet the author, right?
Oh, yeah. So they looked up his widow in Pasadena. And she told them, gosh, you know, John passed just a few months before you called. He would have liked to have met you. And they said, well, we still want to talk to you, Dorothy. So they flew down to Pasadena, and they were eager to find out what other works that he had left. And she said, well, you know, John wrote a second novel about the Issei, the first generation Japanese Americans in America. But I wrote a letter to UCLA, and they weren't interested, and I didn't think anybody cared about the first book, so I just burned it. And Frank and Sean and Lawson were just speechless. They were stunned this second novel was lost, and it remains lost to this day. So Noto Boy has always been shrouded in this kind of mystique and mystery, and that's what drew me to doing this book called John Okada. Clever title from University of Washington Press. because, you know, in interviewing Dorothy, the widow of John Okada, Frank Chin wrote this very evocative essay called In Search of John Okada for the Seattle Weekly. And it was appended as an afterword to all paperback editions, starting with the Carp edition. And you know, it just created a kind of sense of longing and mystery and loss and tragedy that, it stuck with me for 40 years. I'd done a film about the Japanese-American draft resistors for PBS called Conscience and the Constitution in 2000. I thought I'd follow it up with a film about the life of John Okada. I interviewed his family and his friends, and it didn't finish the film because the story wasn't there yet. We hadn't done enough work to understand who John Okada was and what his legacy was. That changed when our collaborator, historian Greg Robinson, scrolling through some microfilms, the Northwest Times, a post-war Seattle Nisei newspaper, and came across five short stories by John Okada, a one-act play, and called me up, wrote to me, and said, do you want these? And I said, my God, you know, Greg, you found these short stories that had been, you know, kind of talked about, but no one had ever seen them. And so then Greg convinced me that this was a book. And then we recruited another literary scholar, Floyd Chung of Smith College. And together we found an additional work. John Okada wrote a poem, The Night of Pearl Harbor, called I Must Be Strong, which was his first piece of creative writing. We have a great discovery in the microfilm of the University of Washington Daily on the front page on December 11th, 4 days after Pearl Harbor. And no one had known about this poem because it was written anonymously. You know, whether it was modesty on John's part or more likely a need to protect his family from retribution in the wake of Pearl Harbor when people like his father were being arrested throughout Seattle for being, you know, suspected collaborators with the enemy.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about the disparity, I guess, between John Okada's own life and of the narrator of Noto Boy Ichiro, because what's interesting is John was not a Noto Boy. He actually had a distinguished career in the military, and he takes on this totally different perspective in writing the novel that I just think is so interesting.
Noto Boy is not an autobiography, and many people mistake it for one. John Okada was a Nisei everyman in many ways. He volunteered for the Military Intelligence Service out of college, and he flew hazardous missions over the Japanese coastline listening for enemy radio signals that could yield valuable information for the Allies. But he wrote a novel about a fellow Nisei with the opposite experience, you know, someone who objected to incarceration and refused to be drafted out of an American concentration camp. And through, you know, this anti-hero, we get dizzying internal monologues arguing with himself about whether he did the right thing or not as the protagonist. That was not Okada's experience. One theory is that all the MIS veterans were conducting secret operations in World War II, and when they were discharged in 1946, they were told to shut up about their wartime experience, kind of a gag order. And they all did. They none of them talked about their experiences, and Okada may have felt that he was not free to write about his own experience. Then he met a fellow in Seattle, high school classmate, you know, not a close friend, a guy named Jim Akutsu, who was a draft resister, a guy who did refuse the draft in the Minidoka concentration camp on the grounds that he'd be glad to fight or be drafted out of a concentration camp if the U.S. would simply let his parents go home and restore his rights as a citizen. You know, that didn't happen. And so he went to trial and was convicted, spent 2 years at McNeil Island Federal Penitentiary south of Seattle, and was released just about the time that Okada got back to Seattle, returned to school, was attending the University of Washington, and was taking creative writing classes. Okada and Akutsu hooked up. John was working in a war surplus store at the time, and Akutsu would go hang out with him. And then John would say, hey, let's go to the Wame Club. Let's go to Taitung, eat, have a meal, have a drink. And Jim started to tell his stories about prison, about being a draft resister, about his mother, who actually, like the protagonist in the novel, shared the delusion that Japan had won the war and that ships would bring, you know, the victorious Japanese to come rescue true believers like her. So John took a lot of notes as Jim was talking. And when he sat down to write 10 years later in Detroit, Michigan, that became the foundation for the novel No-No Boy.
I think that sort of gets at the experience of being Japanese American at the time that Okada was writing this, you know, just 10 years after the internment camps and after the war, because, you know, it presents such a very different view than the one that Japanese Americans themselves had been sort of boxed into as the model minority at the time. Can you talk a bit about how Okada's book and these perspectives sort of blew that open?
Yeah, the model minority was created in the New York Times in a William Peterson essay in 1957. The Japanese American Citizen League, which still exists today, their historian, Bill Hosokawa, wrote a popular history in the late 60s called Nisei, The Quiet Americans. So, you know, the quiet American, the model minority, was the public image of Japanese Americans in the post-war period. And No-No Boy, John Okada's novel, everything about No-No Boy challenges this overall amnesia about the camps, the prevailing values of our community at the time, which mostly wanted to forget and fit in. The novel met with silence.
So can you talk a little bit more about what makes this book so powerful in your mind, and I guess why it stuck with you, why you wanted to pursue this project?
You know, I was hanging out with the CARP boys, the Combined Asian American Resources Project, in San Francisco in the 70s, around the time when they republished the novel. There was just a raw honesty, a raw vernacular in Okada's writing that was unlike anything that we had seen before. A lot of Asian American literature at the time was no more than Chinese American Christian autobiographies, you know, Chinese cookbooks, you know, Japanese travelogues. And this was a raw, unvarnished, gritty voice that, and some, often profane, that revealed this unexpressed anger that the Nisei felt about their treatment by the government in World War II and the fact that really they had been disinherited of, you know, billions of dollars in today's dollars in land, farms, businesses, education, which they could not pass on to the children, my generation. And yet the prevailing idea of don't talk about the camps because we don't want to pass on our anger, our rage, our bitterness. Bitterness was the big word. We don't want to pass on our bitterness to our children because we want them to succeed. We want them to go to college and have a decent life. Not a great life, but a decent life. So Nornal Boy said those things that the Nisei were not able to say. That's probably one reason why they turned away from it when the book came out. It was just something they could not touch.
Yeah, and there's this line I love from Frank Chin's afterword where he says, the book was so good, it freed me to be trivial.
Yeah.
And that it's so great because, I mean, it gives you, having a book that sort of says the unspeakable gives you the option to continue having that conversation or just to leave it aside and talk about whatever you want.
You know, John Okada joked to his friends that he wanted to write the great American novel or the great Japanese American novel or the great Nisei novel. The novel ends after a tragedy in a Chinatown alley, and Ichiro walks towards King Street Station looking for what lies ahead. And all he can find is a faint glimmer of hope, an insinuation of promise, as he calls it. And that's as far as John Okada could take his readers, because he was still 20 years away from the time when Japanese Americans could finally articulate what happened. You know, Okada died in 71, several years before we had the first Day of Remembrance here in Seattle, which would kickstart the popular campaign for redress and reparations.
So, I mean, I guess for the inevitable question, you sort of touched on this earlier, but detainment and incarceration are once again government policy, I should say, for a while now. And we can't help but look back and think about Japanese internment in comparison, especially when politicians make that comparison for us and do it favorably. How do you even begin to compare the two, to put it in perspective when this, we're supposed to learn about history so it doesn't repeat, and yet here we are again?
I started this book under the Obama administration. We allowed ourselves to indulge the belief that we lived in a post-racial society. And books like these were instructive, but they were history. John Okada wrote that the race hatred that put Americans of Japanese ancestry into concentration camps, he described it as the indignation, the hatred, the patriotism of the American people, that targeted innocent Americans following the attack on Pearl Harbor. Well, of course, that's rising once again. In this present moment, we're seeing the normalizing of racism and nativism at the highest levels of government. We have a government now that openly says it's okay to attack others based on their differences, whether it be their religion, their race, or even their immigration status. So you flash forward to the present, and the story of Japanese-American incarceration and Japanese-American resistance to incarceration in the American 20th century is regrettably no longer academic history in the 21st. At this moment, the same prejudices and hysteria are being normalized. And we see that they were always there, that you just need to scratch the surface. And the same feelings that put Japanese-Americans into camp in World War II were always there, just under the surface. The analogies are not precise, but the mass evictions ordered in the name of national security by the Western Defense Command in 1942 are disturbingly echoed by the deportations carried out today by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The experience of mass incarceration was not one pursued by Japanese Americans, obviously, but with the moral kind of authority of that experience comes the moral responsibility for us to stand with others, to stand in defense of others threatened today by the same prejudice, hysteria, and failed political leadership that Congress identified as the causes of the Japanese-American incarceration.
Links to the book John Okada, co-edited by Frank Abe, Greg Robinson, and Floyd Chung, are in our episode notes, along with a ton more links to Nono Boy, Nisei Literature, Frank's PBS special, Conscience and the Constitution, and some of our favorite hyphenated American books. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time. Till then, take care and stay sharp.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.